Hey, do you have a board of directors? I'm not talking about where you work. I'm talking about who you are. Because if you don't have a personal board of directors, you're missing out on some real great opportunities. So stick around. I've got somebody who's going to give you some great information on how to improve your game. Hello and welcome to another episode of CISO Tradecraft, the podcast that provides you with the information, knowledge, and wisdom to be a more effective cybersecurity leader. My name is G. Mark Hardy. I'm your co-host for today, and I have with us Ross Young, whom you've seen before, and I think you're going to see a little bit more of because he is a great guy. He knows an awful lot of stuff, and quite frankly, somebody has some brilliant ideas. Now, quickly, if you're just finding us for the first time, don't forget to subscribe. Also, follow us on LinkedIn. We're a whole lot more than a podcast. We have a Substack newsletter. We have little shorts that we put out and a high signal, low noise news broadcast that'll come out on LinkedIn pretty much on a regular basis, but we're not going to spam you with anything. If you're listening to us on our podcast channel, don't forget to give us a thumbs up or 5-star just so other people can find us a little bit easier. And don't forget to share with everybody else where you're getting your knowledge for your CISO Tradecraft. So, Ross, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So we were talking a little bit beforehand about the concept of a personal board of directors. Now, for some people, they're saying, oh, come on, really? But there's actually something to that. Can you tell us a little bit more about this concept and perhaps where you first ran across it?
Yeah, so I was in a meeting this week, and we were discussing all sorts of being a mentor, being a mentee, and how to help. And there was this very astute lady who I won't name, but she mentioned having a personal board of directors. And it was also shared a number of different resources, which we'll put as show notes. But, you know, it's an interesting thought. You know, CEOs get smarter by having this board of directors that they can get counsel from with different perspectives. There's a chief finance officer usually on a board of directors. There's former CEOs, other things that can provide perspectives of been there, done that. So the CEO doesn't have to make the mistake as a first-time CEO. And I just think that's so brilliant. And how do we bring that to cyber professionals?
Well, it's an interesting concept. Now, we think about in the corporation and the way that governance is organized is that we have a board of directors who is responsible for the overall direction of the organization, but the CEO is a person who's supposed to execute that mission from the board of directors. So to a certain extent, the CEO / president, and by the way, they're different roles, and if you're not familiar with the roles, president is basically a functionary role. Okay, who is the president of Microsoft? Brad Smith. Everybody knows that, right? No, Satya Nadella is a guy everybody knows, and he's a CEO. Well, it turns out that the president is a functionary requirement. You have to have one for an organization. They preside over meetings and things such as that, and they also have certain legal responsibilities. But the CEO is appointed by the board. And it turns out that from that perspective, the board is telling the CEO, here are your goals, here are your objectives, here's what you're going to do. And oh, by the way, yes, you can learn along the way. But if you don't execute, you get fired. Now, we're reversing the dynamic a little bit. We're saying, hey, here the personal CEO, me, is going to be, if you will, employing the board not to go ahead and follow their direction, but rather to see clarity and advice and insight from them. Is that a correct characterization of what we're talking about?
Yeah. We're hiring these folks who can help us without, you know, essentially hiring people to fire us out of our own, you know, roles, if you will. And I think it's a powerful thing, right? We all need feedback. And I would even say that some of this feedback doesn't even have to come from a person. It could come from a book, right? So if you think, hey, I really need to get financial literacy skills, you could probably read a book on that that could just help you just as much. But sometimes having a real person where you can ask questions is just so valuable when you're hung up on a certain concept.
Now, talking about hiring them, do I need to break out my checkbook and say, I'm sorry, I'd like you to be on my board of directors, what's your hourly rate? Or is this something that's more of a relationship-based engagement?
You know, I have found my best relationships not to be in formal programs. I'm not to say, you know, those don't work for people, but they didn't work for me. And what I found was I wanted to find someone that I naturally clicked with, where we just had, you know, matching personalities a little bit. And then from that, you know, building that relationship. And one of the other big things you need to understand is a good relationship isn't just taking information from the mentor. The mentee should also be a mentor to the mentor in some ways, right? And I know it's a little confusing, but think about it this way. A CISO probably hasn't been a first-time coder in 20 years in their career. And so they don't actually know what the onboarding process is for new developers. And so if you can share that with them and show them how it's broken as the mentee in that relationship, you are mentoring the CISO, right? So things like that, where it's a give and take back and forth, I think makes a super productive thing so that the mentor wants to continue to learn from the mentee in this relationship.
Well, that sounds good. Now, for the matter of terminology, for people who maybe think of it as a protege or a mentee, we're equating them. So down in Florida, we think of mentees as those big things that float slowly around, but of course, the manatees. But whatever term you use, in the military, we called it mentor and protege. And we had mentorship programs because in that type of an organization, you're constantly training your replacement. There's always a goal to be able to help the next generation become this following generation of leadership. And as a result, you don't hold back. And they say if you're irreplaceable, you can't be promoted. And so from that perspective, what you want to be able to do is twofold. One is train your replacement, which is kind of, we think of as a mentorship, but also seeking out the advice, counsel, and wisdom and direction of people who are more senior to you or more experienced than you, which is what we're talking about here from mentorship. Now, as we look at a personal board of directors, are there any other goals other than mentorship that we could consider as being a good reason for doing so?
So even beyond mentorship, I think sponsorship is huge,
yeah,
right? Because let's say you decide to get someone who's, you know, three levels above you as one of your mentors, and it may not even be in your own division, but all of a sudden they take notice of, wow, this is really, really helpful. I think this person's a rock star and they're doing really, really good things. A lot of times those people will notice things at their level that are not visible to the mentee. Like, hey, this person's going to retire in 2 months. We need to plan the transition of who's going to replace that person. Or we're going to do, you know, some big thing that's a temporary effort and we need a champion to lead this initiative just for 3 months. And so their ability to sponsor and say, have you considered this person? He's just been really solid. I think he'd do an excellent job, him or her, in that role. That can be another fascinating thing to get, not just advice, but also sponsorship.
Yeah, and I think that's really important because as we talked about several times on the show, there's different phases of careers. We start out in a technical phase, and then from there, if we do well, we're given management, execute on time, on a budget. When we get to the CISO level, we're looking at leadership roles, being able to set the vision, motivate your team, etc. But when the sponsorship is really that fourth level, which is the political layer, which is really where things happen. And we find out that in many organizations, some of the best technical people never do well in management or don't get to management. If they don't get to management, by the way, it might be a good thing, unless you're in an up or out career like the military. Some of the best managers just can't, they couldn't lead people out of a burning building. And some of the leaders may be inspirational and people do anything for them, but with a blind eye toward the politics of an organization, they're going to stall out and retire as a leader. And they might be perfectly fine with that. But at the CISO level, it's more than just leadership. It's leadership and political acumen. You're correct. We've left our technical skills behind. To a certain extent, the management is delegatable to those who are direct reports, but leadership falls squarely on our shoulders. But to even get to our job, let alone succeed and progress, we need that political acumen. And that's where the correct selection of these personal board of directors can really be helpful. So with that in mind, what do we look for as we're quote unquote recruiting our board of directors? And will people just say yes, or how do we coach that in a way that's going to cause them to be more likely to say yes than no?
You know, I think the first board of director member that I would look for is someone who's been in the role that I aspire to,
mm-hmm.
right? So maybe I am a head of AppSec and I desire one day to be a CISO. Well, I think the best advice is probably going to come from someone who's been a CISO or is currently a CISO, right? And Steve Jobs has this famous quote where they were looking at bringing all these consultants in. And while they understood management, they didn't grow up through the ranks, so they didn't know anything. And he calls them bozos because the people weren't able to learn from them and they had to let them all go. And so I think that's the first thing. Find people who've done things, because what you're going to find is there's a proven pattern, right? How is it that someone becomes a CISO? Well, if you look, there may be four traditional routes that people grow through. They grow up in the SOC. They grow up on the GRC side of the house. They grow up in, you know, AppSec vol management, or maybe they grow up in a non-traditional path. And if you don't see yourself going up those traditional recommendations, you have a much harder job trying to get those same opportunities when you don't look same as what normally gets promoted, right?
And I think what you'll find is you're really key to point out that there are multiple pathways to becoming a CISO. Let me draw again a parallel to my military career. And so for those of us who had made it to 06, captain, and every captain thinks they're going to be a great admiral, the reality of it is one half of 1% of captains will promote to rear admiral. And so there's that eye of the needle. We all figure we're great. So what happens? You tend to look for the people who get selected this year and they say, what job did they have? Oh, they were in this particular assignment. So then everybody applies for that assignment, figuring that that was the magic. But then it turns out that, nope, next year was somebody. And they're all chasing around like a crowd looking for the last winning lottery ticket.
G. Mark, I think I've heard you on an earlier episode said, you know, there's kind of traditional paths. Like you're either a subsurface, let's call it a submarine officer that gets right. promoted. You are a surface warfare officer, you know, someone running the big ships, or you're a pilot. Those are like the most likely paths to get to be, you know, an admiral in the Navy.
Right. And that's what you're in case. The big bucket. But now we're saying as you get closer to the top in that career, you're not going to cross over. Although it's interesting because, again, staying with the Navy analogy for a moment, from my experience has been in the Navy Reserve, at 05, a commander, that's your last opportunity as a pilot to get command. You get command of a squadron, which is a big deal. I mean, it's huge. You've got hardware, you've got millions of dollars of equipment, dozens of men and women, and you have a real mission assignment there. And then what happens at that point? Well, when you pin on your Eagles and you become an 06, you kind of get lumped in with all the surface warfare officers. Now, think of the culture of your organization. If you are a CISO or a leader and you have to groom the next generation of leadership, we had a saying in the Navy in the surface warfare community where I grew up that SWOs eat their young, meaning what? You look for any possible defect they made, and boy, golly, you're going to document the fact that they screwed this up and they screwed that up. And so you pick up a lot of dents and dings and errors along the way in your record, and your record reflects the fact, well, you're human. Well, the pilots, we used to joke, they said if you had 10 pilots, they all got ranked 1 out of 10. 1 out of 10, 1 out of 10. Well, what used to be before they computerized everything is the squadron CO was, the admiral said, here's what you do. Don't send them all in at once like you're supposed to. Send them in one at a time. And then 2 days later, send the next one. Send the next one. The Bureau's not going to sort it out. So what happens when you're up for 06? Because I sat on that 06 command board. And I noticed that the surface warfare officers went like this. And the aviators look like that. And you know, the admiral said, hey, by the way, this is why these guys do so well, and women, at this level and beyond. So understand the culture of your organization. If you have a zero defect mentality, and therefore you're looking for perfection, but your organization doesn't share that, you're going to do some real damage. Or if we look at Steve Ballmer, when he was at Microsoft, one of the big sources of angst there was what? He required each business unit to bottom blow 10% of their organization every year. If I had 10 PhD Nobel Prize winning scientists, I'd have to fire one of them every 12 months. And it was just unilateral. And that was one of the number of things that created some toxic culture there. But back to the personal board of directors, as we look at that, your insight is excellent. Find somebody who has served and been successfully served at the level that you want to do. I'll go one beyond that, and that person also has to take a personal and professional interest in your success. I can't just walk up to Phil Venables and say, hey, wow, you've been like world-class CISO all the time, so be my mentor. I've had people come to me all the time, be my mentor. I taught for SANS for almost 10 years, and people at the end of my leadership class like, you're my mentor. Like, they're ordering me, you are going to be my mentor. It's just, it doesn't work that way. So how do we entice somebody who is very busy, reasonably successful, and probably doesn't have a whole lot of stake in your professional and personal success? How do we convince these people that they should be on our board?
So one of the first things that I have seen is cyber is a very generous community. Most people want to help the next generation because I think many of us didn't really get good guidance and help growing up through the ranks. So like Phil Venables has an amazing blog. He's very much one to give back. Mm-hmm. The second thing that I would say is if you really want someone to help you, make sure you are not wasting their time. If you go to a meeting and you're like, I don't know, tell me everything I need to do, that's a very one-sided meeting. Versus if you go to a meeting and you bring an agenda saying, here's 5 to 10 questions I'm really struggling with right now, and I'd love to maybe just to ponder and talk through these thoughts and these things and get your recommendations. That is a really rewarding meeting for a mentor to give advice to, and they don't feel like they're wasting their time. And so I think of, are you putting as much prep into making that a very productive meeting? If you do that, you have the best chance of making it very rewarding. And then I think the other thing I would say is also find a way to connect on a human level, right? So for example, a lot of times when I'm in conversations with people, I usually ask people about what are their favorite hobbies? What do they like to do? And then just talking about their hobbies, which most people are not interested in your hobbies, just kind of opens them up. And then they're like, man, I really like talking to this person because we have just these interesting conversations instead of how's the weather? What'd you do? Oh, I went shopping at Costco over the weekend and nothing interesting, right?
And you got to make sure, of course, you're not making them feel self-conscious, because some of us get so involved in our job and our life and everything else like that, our hobbies have kind of set to the side. I remember I did a presentation up at Fort Meade a couple of years ago, and the two-star said, well, hey, this is G. Mark Hardin. Tell me about your hobby. And it's like, man, my hobby has been my podcast, and this doesn't sound like a really fun hobby. But I am restoring my old car. Yeah, I've still got my first car, a 1960 Corvette. That's the good news. The bad news is it's been waiting for me to replace the fuel pump for 3 years. It's still up on the ramps. It's like, come on, Hardy, it's been forever. Well, it's just a matter of maybe finding a technical mentor, like somebody who works in a garage or likes old cars, and said, hey, want to come on over here and we'll cook dinner, cook ribs, something like that, and make it worth your while. Because rather, or I could just drag the thing into a shop and have somebody do that. Well, we can't just drag ourselves into the shop. But as you said, find something that personally connects them. And that's really key. The other thing also is this. As a mentor, when I'm approached by a protege or a potential protege saying, hey, would you like to help me out? There is an assignable risk to me as a mentor that I have to accept. What do I mean by that? If I am a mentor and I choose to accept somebody as a protege who is not going to follow through, who doesn't do their homework, who ends up not becoming successful and a failure, what does that do to my reputation among my peers? This Hardy guy, he just kind of push everybody who goes to him fails. So you are causing a perception of risk when you go to a successful mentor. What's the best way, in your opinion, to reduce that vision of risk? And in fact, maybe even make it look like a positive risk.
I think you go in and honestly, I don't think you ask for a formal mentoring relationship. Mm-hmm. I think you just go in and ask some questions. Say, hey, I'd like your advice on the following. And then you just go and naturally connect, right? I don't think anybody, when they meet their spouse for the first time, says, hey, do you want to get married, right? I think you come in a little softer than that, right? And I think that same advice applies in a mentorship, right? It doesn't have to be so formal. And you know what? After that first meeting, if it's terrible, you never have to meet that person again in that type of capacity. But if it's really, really good, at the end of the meeting, be like, you know what? I really enjoyed this conversation. I'd love to continue it again. Maybe we can meet up for lunch in a couple months or in 2-3 weeks, you know, whatever you feel the timing is appropriate.
Mm-hmm.
And then just leave it like that and see how it goes. And I think just that more casual, natural progression makes a lot more sense. And then you're just building up these natural friendships that also turn into really good advisory panels for you.
And that's a good point. One of the interesting thing is, so I work with some students here in the Tampa Bay area. And I had one of the students, I met her at one of the security conferences here that I spoke at. I'm trying to remember which one, something or other. And I said, hey, you want to get into security. She's a junior electrical engineer, but like cybersecurity. And let me buy you a ticket to B-Sides. And then afterwards, had her come over to the house. Well, Mike made us lunch and things like that. And we talked about different projects. She wanted new hardware. I said, well, hey, I've got a couple of Raspberry Pis. Let's go ahead and let me set out this concept of this project I have in mind. And we worked on it and things such as that. And we said, okay, well, she wanted to write it up. So I said, well, take them home with you. So I figured I'd get back like a one paragraph. I just pulled it up right now. So there's a 3-page outline, not an outline, a summary of, you know, to G. Marcardi from this person, overview of what we did with a statement of the problem, a statement of the solution, flow of how it would work, what we did today, what I learned, key takeaways, and my next steps. And the deadline is what I'm going to do for an upcoming goal. I mean, wow. So this is a university junior who's already got this well organized. Now, some people might say, yeah, well, she fed it all to ChatGPT or something. I don't care. The point is that what does that tell me as a mentor as to what risk, if you will, that I'm taking on? This is a person who's going places. I bought her a ticket again this year to come to B-Sides, and we stayed in touch. And so as a result, if you finish up, instead of, hey, I'd love to get together for lunch in a month or two, what I would recommend going one more is that, hey, based upon our conversation, there's 2 or 3 takeaways that I have. And I'm going to commit to doing them. And let's talk about it in a month or so over lunch to see how well I did. Now, at that point, I know you have a stake in following through in my advice. And you're right. People feel good about being a mentor. And oh, by the way, I've always been told in the venture capital world, if you ask somebody for money, they're not going to give you advice. But if you ask somebody for advice, they might offer you money. So keep that in mind. It's not a hard and fast rule, but a general rule.
Yeah, I like that advice. And thank you for sharing that. I think that's really key. You know, another aspect I think we should also be discussing is who else should be on the board of directors. I know we mentioned, you know, someone in that role that you aspire to. And, you know, I think there's other types of folks. What do you think are some of the other roles that we should put on our panel, if you will?
Well, I'm going to go back to an author from 1937. Napoleon Hill wrote a book called Think and Grow Rich. And one of the things he has in terms of his recommendations for success is mastermind. And not just a mastermind, but the power of the mastermind by being able to say, if you want to be successful, what you want to do is create a group. And the idea is no individual may have great power without availing himself, considering that, okay, himself, herself, but this is 1937, of the mastermind. And so the idea here is that the author is suggesting that you can accumulate through other people that you associate with in a spirit of sympathy and harmony. I would say more synthesis, I guess, probably different words that we use 90 years later. But the whole idea is that he is suggesting that what you do is by creating this personal board of directors, what he called your mastermind, is that these people are going to be able to assist you in different areas. And one of the concepts is that imagine that you had great people throughout history. You had not only Napoleon Hill, but he's talking about, let's say you had Abraham Lincoln sitting around, and maybe Julius Caesar, and perhaps Descartes or whatever. Now, you can't just pick these names out of a hat. You have helped to have read a lot about them. In a way, it's almost like we become our own AI system. We've read enough information about a particular person that we think would be a great historical mentor, if they're not physically here today, that if we sat down and in our mind, imagine I'm having a face-to-face conversation with this person whom I deeply respect, what would they say in this context? And so from that perspective, your imagination kind of runs wild. Here, we have the opportunity to use real-life people. But do your homework a little bit too. So if I know that Ross Young is writing a book and he's talking about what about your budgets and why your money is wasted, then he's got some expertise that he has spent in working on his book about understanding how to correctly allocate funds. If I want to become a CISO, that's a core element of my ability to hold that job and to be successful is to be a good fiduciary, responsible nature for the funds that I get and to successfully lobby for the ones that I do need to grow my security programs. So because I did my homework on this guy, I'm not going to ask him about other things such as, well, what's the best way to work on my golf swing so I could go ahead and play golf with the CEO? No, do your homework. Understand what these people can potentially bring to the table. So beyond just the CISO, think of where we might have either blind spots or weak spots, some things that we may not do all that well. And for example, people who want to get to public speaking, they say, well, go to Toastmasters. It's a great opportunity. And I've been speaking and presenting for years, and people say, did you ever do Toastmasters? They said, no. Why? I just grounded out the hard way. I just did hundreds and hundreds of presentations and over the time learned my own technique. That said, however, if somebody wants to be better at that area, they know that they're whisper, whatever, all the things that don't work too well as a public persona, doesn't have to necessarily mean I have to have a personal speaking coach. There are resources out there as well that you can take advantage of if you make the time commitment to it. So speaking of time commitment, what allocation of time should we be making toward this improvement on our skill sets? And what time commitment do you think that we could reasonably request out of mentors?
You know, I think 1 hour every 2 to 3 weeks, if it's someone that you're pretty close with, makes sense, right? Maybe you go out to lunch every 2 or 3 weeks with someone.
Mm-hmm.
I think if it's someone that you're not as close with, maybe once a quarter is probably more appropriate. It all comes back to how often are things changing, right? Mm-hmm. That you need new advice. If you don't have anything new to tell this person, then you're just wasting their time unless you really have a lengthy conversation that didn't finish and you need more time. So I would look for, hey, these 10 new things happened to me and now I need, you know, this new advice.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing I would also say, maybe on our previous discussion here, is I would tell people to look for what I'm going to call grave diggers, people who know where the dead bodies are in the organization and where things have gone and struggled. And you just think about it. There's probably some people who are architects that have been in the company for 20 years, right? They know the broken processes. They've probably tried to do things and been shot down by previous management or leadership. And so I think if you go and you talk to those folks and you say, hey, tell me something that we should do that we haven't done yet, you can learn a lot from those discussions. And it's not just the architects. It's also the customer help desk. Like, what tickets do we get the most of that are just wasting your time that if we fix would just make your life better? Right. So having those people who know where these dead bodies are that need to be, you know, kind of fixed in our organization because we're just getting more of them, I think is a really an other important thing to add to our board of directors.
Excellent insight. And one of the things that a reference that you had actually introduced me to from the University of Georgia on a personal board of directors is it recommends having 7 different categories of people, a challenger, someone who is going to try to push you to doing something that you might not do on your own otherwise, but that encouragement gets you. A cheerleader who's always going and motivating you, because let's face it, we're human. Sometimes we get demotivated. A coach. A coach is a little bit different than a cheerleader, of course, is that a coach is going to go ahead and put you through your paces and require you to do certain things, which you might not like at the time, but that discipline is what you're going to gain from that. A connector, which we've already talked about, somebody who could link you in with other people in the organization, absolutely essential, particularly when you're realizing that you're getting to that political layer and relationships are the currency of that realm, not money, not accomplishment, and not even reputation. Then there's the mentor, which we've been talking about a lot, which is someone to help you develop your skills. We've mentioned role model, somebody who's already been successful in that. And you've also mentioned sponsor, somebody who could introduce you to that next level and say, hey, welcome, if you will, to the neighborhood, sort of like the welcome wagon to the executive suite. And you've covered a lot of those things. So it seems like intuitively, you've got an excellent grasp on doing this personal board of directors. So well done on that one.
And I'll give you one more that you may not think about. You know, everybody always wants to talk to the leader. But most big leaders in big organizations have an admin or a chief of staff. And those people know the secrets about that person because their whole job is really, how do I make this life or this person's life easier, right? And so if you go and you talk to them and be like, hey, what would really work well with this? Or who do you think, you know, this person would really agree with, or who should we talk to? You might be surprised to learn that they know that this person spends all their time with here. These are the people this person goes to for advice. And using that as a way to influence or increase your influence with some of these organizational leaders can be really powerful.
And that's a brilliant insight. For example, if I want to influence the President of the United States on something, very unlikely I'm going to get a one-on-one meeting. But if I can find the people who are advising the president, somebody who has that person's ear, I listen to that, but maybe get to that person, even that advisor. Look for the people that are trusted by your, for lack of a better word, target. And if I'm trying to create an initial relationship with somebody who is perhaps two or three levels above, where I just can't walk in the front door, I'm going to get turned away, find out who gives them advice. Be polite, be nice, create a friendly relationship. And then at that point in time, they may get you onto the person's calendar. It's a little, it's not manipulation. It's basically understanding how politics works.
Yeah. If John always trusts Jackie because Jackie is just brilliantly smart and just executes to the nines, and Jackie says, you know what, we ought to take a risk on Ross. Well, naturally, I have this level of trust coming in. So if you can think about those things, those high valued referrals, I think that's a fantastic place to look at.
And it's a very good point. And so as we do that, and as we look at these potential third parties, of course, recognize that they will be a little bit initially guarded. Well, why are you trying to talk to the big boss? You're not. But if you approach them and build a trust with them first, then you're not going at them with an agenda. At least it's not an obvious agenda. But at which point you can say, hey, I'm really struggling with this issue. If you know anybody who could help me out, of course they know somebody who can help me out. It's the person you're looking for. And so what we're finding then is that a personal board of directors should include a range of different capabilities. Do these people all have to be friends with each other? Do they even have to know each other? Or can I do this asynchronously rather than call my board of directors meeting once a month?
I don't think they have to know about each other. I don't think they have to be involved with each other. But the one thing I would always say is make sure it's someone that you have a really good, trusted relationship with. There's a lot of people who could be amazing board of directors for other people, but I just don't connect with on a deep personal level. And so if I don't really connect with them, I think it's really, really hard to spend more and more time with them to make valuable relationships with those. Now, don't get me wrong. In any role, there are people you are forced to connect to. If you're the CISO, you're going to spend time with legal, you're going to spend time with HR, and maybe you don't want to connect with those people, but you need to. But that doesn't mean they have to be your board of directors or your mentor for a really important thing. Maybe you get a chief of HR from a different company who you do connect with on that personal level, and they give you just as great advice.
That's true. So some relationships, if you will be transactional, and others are going to be more substantive. And really what we're looking at here is going beyond the transactional relationship to one where we're transcending just the dispensation of professional advice, kind of like Lucy, the psychiatrist, is in 5 cents for advice, but rather to create, if you will, more of a personal interest. And we do so, as you had suggested, by maybe taking some interest. You know, what are their hobbies? What do they like to do outside of the workplace? Most people do have something. Some people are just so focused on what they do that they don't have that. And so be careful that if they feel self-conscious about being put on the spot, like, well, hey, tell everybody about your hobby. yeah, it's like fixing the car that I haven't been fixing on for 3 years. Yeah, it was a little bit embarrassing. I got a better answer today. I'm basically becoming a pizza chef. I bought a pizza oven and now I made fresh pizzas last night from homemade dough and they're still getting there. They're almost round. I guess I'm told it takes a few more tries before you really get it and you can flip them up in the air. But that's something interesting and fun to do and totally orthogonal to everything else I'm doing, which is sometimes what your hobbies are. Now, if you find somebody who's never given advice before, maybe being a mentor or on a board of directors is something new for them, or even if they have been doing it, one caution is that just because they give you advice doesn't mean it's accurate for you. So how do we use our own discernment when somebody says, close your eyes and let go of the rope and fall to the floor? And you think you might be 20 or 30, 50 meters up. And when you let go, you're only this far away. But you didn't know that, but they did. Or maybe you fall and crash and burn. How do we discern that?
So the first thing I will say is a lot of really important discussions, you shouldn't just have one conversation with one person. You should have a sounding board across multiple people. Right. So let's just say there's an opportunity for you to step into a new role, but you don't think it's a good fit. Right. Maybe you've always been in cybersecurity and they're like, hey, we want you to take this role where you're going to head the PMO in the IT department. And you're like, oh, that sounds horrible. You know, I don't want to deal with budgets and money and all of these things. And you have that insight and you're like, I think this would be just terrible. I just wouldn't like it. And you talk to three or four people and they say, you know what? If you're actually going to manage a $1 billion program, you better understand how to manage the budget. And that's what you're going to get in this role. And it's a trial role before we promote you into that larger role. And if you don't do this, you're not going to get those aspirational roles that you want. And you hear that from a couple people, you should really pay attention. But if you only hear that from one person and you don't hear that from the rest of your cadre, and they're like, no, this person just wants you in that role because he's trying to fill a vacancy, you know, that's where it's you need a sounding board across multiple people to understand how it helps you in your career set.
Yeah, and it's interesting because you're absolutely right. I had an opportunity where I was offered to be the acting chief information officer for the United States Navy. Wow, as a reservist, they're going to get called back to active duty and become the CIO. And you know, what an awesome opportunity. And this is, 15 years ago. But what came out of that was a couple of things that were head scratchers. First of all, the incumbent CIO, who is also a reservist, he's going to mobilize to go over to the Gulf. But he said, well, you can't use my office and you can't use my title. You got to go sit in the other room with the Booz Allen consultants. Red flag one. And then, do I get to go ahead and interview with your boss? No. Red flag two. And it's like something, I ended up not taking the position. And it turned out that, and what I found out is that this person, nothing against him, because he understood the politics of his organization better than I did. But he did not want someone to be wildly successful. The idea was he wants someone who could keep the organization running long enough for him to come back and rescue everything after 6 months, be the hero, and get a promotion, which he eventually did. But I just did not want to be that column fodder of that. You also mentioned about somebody wanting to fill in their role. About a month later, I got an interview with a 3-star admiral who wanted me to become his CIO. And that was Naval Installations Command, a multi-billion dollar, basically anything the Navy has that doesn't float is Naval Installations Command, which is a lot around the world. And that was a huge job. But two things. One was, you'd point out at the beginning of the show, I'm not a chief information officer career track in the Navy. I'm a surface warfare officer. All right. And so that would be tangential track. And it turned out his real agenda was that they had Navy had direction to build up Guam. And so he basically needed someone to create all the IT infrastructure in Guam, half a world away. Nothing to say Guam isn't a nice place, but that was going to be essentially where I'd be living for 2 years, making that happen. And so as a result, we want to go ahead and, as you had said, try to discern what is the motivation behind it. Is somebody giving you good advice or is somebody just trying to plug a square peg in a square hole and move on to it and really is not interested in you, just wants that job done? The other thought that occurred to me when you're mentioning about one person being kind of one-odd out. Let's imagine, for example, let's bring it back home more to a security example. I need, for some reason, a copy of TrueCrypt. I found an old encrypted drive or an old encrypted file that I need to decrypt. And I got rid of the software. Well, TrueCrypt is no longer supported anymore. And yeah, I know this other can't be a crypt, but let's stay with TrueCrypt. The last official release came out in 2012. It was version 7.1 alpha. Well, you can find, if you search around, a 7.1 Bravo, a 7.2, and even an 8. All of those are non-official versions, and they might be Trojanized. And even if you found one labeled 7.1 alpha, how do you know that that's not a Trojan version of the software? Because there's no official distribution. And so from a security perspective, you'd go and maybe go to 5 different places. And I think I did that, 5 or 6 different sites. And then I did a hash on each one of them, a SHA-256, and found out that 5 of the 6 matched and 1 of them didn't match. Which one do you think was the Trojan software? I'm pretty sure it was the one that didn't match. And so I went with crowdsourcing, and I got the right version, and I was able to decrypt that thing. So that tells us then that we can don't just walk away and someone gives you something, hey, Ross, do this. And you go, okay, sudo this, and it just happens. Vet that. Run it by other people. And if somebody says, this is non-intuitive, and it doesn't make sense to you now, and I get that it doesn't make sense to you now, but we've been talking for months. You know I care about you. You know I want to see you succeed. This is something that is going to be critical for your success, and it's because of its very non-intuitiveness that it's going to give you an advantage over somebody else trying to do what you want to do. Now, that's the leap of faith. That's let go of the rope and fall to the floor. It might happen.
And I think that's a great thing. You know, when I look back in my career and I say, what are the jobs I'm most happy I took? They're not the jobs that I expected them to be.
Mm-hmm.
The jobs that I went in thinking this is going to be the coolest job, a lot of times weren't my favorite jobs. 3 years later. And any of these jobs that I took because, you know, someone recommended me and there was an opportunity to go over here. And I'm like, okay, let me go over here and just kind of fill some time for a little bit and learn some new things. Oh my goodness, did those things take off? And I'll just tell you one role. You know, I went into one role where I ended up learning DevOps and I ended up learning cloud AWS.
Mm-hmm.
And this was in 2014 timeframe. And it was so different than offensive cyber, which had historically been my track. But, you know, fast forward to 2025, where I'm at, you know, cloud is everywhere. DevOps is everywhere. And by being a pioneer in some of those spaces, you know, I was able to set up a much larger career. And so understanding kind of where technology is going to evolve. And I think the answer right now is AI, machine learning, and some of the way AI generative code is changing things.
Mm-hmm.
Getting a really good understanding of being on that emerging tech sometimes can be a massive bonus for years later.
That's a very good insight. And as we get close to the end of the show, let's kind of summarize what we've been talking about. The issue was the idea of a personal board of directors, other than a corporate board of directors, where the flow, the direction is really coming from you trying to learn from the board rather than a corporate where the board is telling the CEO to do, right? You'd also point out the importance of having different elements on that board of directors, people who could challenge you, who could be your coach or mentor or a role model or a sponsor, and don't just limit yourself to 5 people that are in that same role, maybe diversify across that. We talked about creating a bi-directional relationship where a mentor assuming responsibility for somebody else's success takes on the risk of that person not being successful. So you want to do everything you can to convince that person that it's worth their time and effort to help you along because your success is going to reflect very well on that person and that person's career. And then lastly, as we look at some of the opportunities that are out there, some may be non-intuitive. As you had said, some of your best career opportunities weren't what you were looking for, but it turned out in the long range to have worked out really, really well for you. So don't reject something out of hand simply because it doesn't match your prior pattern of behavior. Because if you do what you've been doing, you're going to get what you've been getting. And what we want is to do something a little bit different. Any other thoughts you have?
I'll just give you one last one that I've been tinkering with a lot lately. A lot of times I use ChatGPT or Claude for queries.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll use a query like, based on everything I've ever asked, what do you think I should do? Or I'll ask about technologies and ask for recommendations and get some really interesting things. So sometimes it doesn't even have to be a human. I mentioned earlier, you know, maybe you're reading a book from an expert, but I would tell you also consider some of these LLMs that you can ask questions with. And if you're asking, you know, dozens of questions every day, it knows probably about as much as your best friend about you. And some of its advice can actually be really, really good.
Well, Ross, with that excellent advice, I think we're going to wrap up the show for today. Thank you very much for being part of our audience out there at CISO Tradecraft. Whether you're watching or listening, we're glad to have you. We hope that this information has been helpful and valuable for you in your career and moving you along in your own tradecraft for your career journey. This has been Ross Young. I'm G. Mark Hardy. We're pleased to spend this time with you. And if you love this episode, give us some feedback. Go ahead and connect with us on LinkedIn. We're both on LinkedIn, plus CISO Tradecraft is there. And give us some questions. Who knows? Maybe if you put all this to good work, you might pick up one of these people as a mentor if you think we could help you out. So until next time, thank you very much for being part of CISO Tradecraft, and stay safe out there.